When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Bryce and Hunt are stunned by the reveal of Sabine's potential meddling in evidence that suggests she is the one behind Danica's murder. While they continue their investigation and review Victoria's evidence of the Kristalos demon, Rune conducts his own research into meta-witch techniques that could repair Luna's horn. With limited new information on their hands, Bryce and Hunt push forward their investigation by going back to the scene of where the Kristalos demon was last seen, only to realize that they must finally face Sabine to determine whether they can catch her in a lie that will prove her involvement in her daughter's death. The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
This is part one of this week's episode. Stick around for part two, which releases on Thursday. Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series. This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. This week, we're discussing chapters 38 through 43 of House of Earth and Blood.
This week, we ask ourselves, where are Bryce and Hunt in their healing journey?
Themes we see in this section include attraction and testing boundaries. We start part three of House of Earth and Blood with chapter 38. So before we dive in, I recognized that we never talked about the names of the different parts. So I just want to acknowledge that at this point, we've gone through the Hollow, the Trench, and the Canyon, which are layers of Hell, which also continue in Sky and Breath. So I'm curious to see what the parts are going to be named in Flame and Shadow, because she's run out of levels of Hell.
Yeah. Also, where this lands in the MC universe, just our universe, the AJ universe. Crescent City 3 comes out on Tuesday for us.
Yes, we are 2 days away from Flame and Shadow. So
I'm losing my shit.
We still know nothing. Between part one and two, we had a time jump. But why are we separating part two from part three? We've just learned the news that Sabine may have tampered with evidence. I think a new part is starting right now because our heroes are getting closer to the truth, even if their sights are on the wrong target, right? They're looking to Sabine as the potential murderer. They're not quite right, but they are headed in the right direction. I also think the new part is starting right now because the bonds between Bryce and Hunt are growing stronger. We've officially crossed over into the friend zone, and their relationship is going to continue to grow, only for it to fall. But I think it's an important transition in their relationship, which is why we're transitioning into a new part. As we enter this chapter, Hunt is upset that Bryce can't face Sabine without feeling really weak. He acknowledges that Bryce was strong against the Viper Queen, against Philip Briggs, against Rune and his friends, and she's got sass, she's got spark. But when it comes to Sabine, Bryce cowers. In Hunt's mind, Sabine's not worthy of Bryce's fear. And I think that's, from my point of view, why he's like, why? Why do you feel this way?
It's really, I hate saying interesting, but it's interesting to read it from his perspective because of just how Hunt copes with Bryce's, I don't know, like struggle with what's happening. I found it very curious to see how he reacts and where he stands with it, because he seems really confused. And I think, like, at this point, we find out, like, Hunt likes Bryce when she's strong.
Yeah.
He likes her when she's holding a gun and is able to shoot bullets through everything. It's a reminder that Bryce is the alpha hole sometimes in their relationship. And he likes her as the alpha hole. Mm-hmm. And the alpha hole isn't holing.
It's not alpha-ing?
No, I saw what I said. Isn't alpha holing. Even, like, the way that she looks is hard for him to observe. Quote, in a pair of sleeping shorts and an oversized worn t-shirt, she looked young, small, tired. All right, well, first off, she is young.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know we're all like, yay, she's 25, but he's several hundred years old.
Yeah.
We come back to this struggle of, this is a man who's gone through so much. She is but a wee child.
Yes, yes.
It's,
she is more developed than Feyre or Aelin were, but somehow the mate is still hundreds of years old.
She's still baby girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Like, and I think it's like, HGM's like, look, he's not 500 years old. It's like, oh.
You know what? Give me a human male that's 20-something and a couple hundred-year-old female fey mate.
Yes, please.
Although, I feel like it just would be disastrous because the fey would not put up with the male shit.
They really would. That's why the fey males have to go with such a young, impressionable women, because they're like, you're too dumb to know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, give me a 50-year-old human male. Maybe he's learned something. I don't know.
Something.
I think what SJM's trying to teach us is human men just can't cut it.
She's like, we need them to grow up by hundreds of years to reach our level emotionally.
Yeah.
As I said, Hunt is drawn to her strength sexually, mentally, everything, and I think that what's also kind of like messes with him right now is that this is mirroring Hunt when he saw Sandril. Bryce was the one who helped him get out of that funk, and he's going to be the one to help her get out of this one. But I think it's also kind of a moment of like seeing himself in her. And in that moment, like, if you think about it, Bryce has been, now not including the night he saw her, he first met her and she was like, went through that, you know, whole traumatic thing. But since then, Bryce has been indestructible, you know, and I think he's been relying on her strength quite a bit without knowing.
Yeah.
The sexual tension on Hunt's part is through the roof. As we've been saying over and over, he likes Bryce strong. So why are we getting this side of him now, this unbelievably horny side? And I don't think that it's because he's getting off on her pain. It's the worst timing to suddenly be really into her. I think it's because she's in such a, okay, like, I'm not trying to say that he's into her pain, but I think she's in such a low, vulnerable spot. It allows him to be vulnerable too, even just mentally.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, her mind is breaking. So can mine.
Yeah.
I too can be attracted. And it starts with comfort initially. You know, Hunt doesn't go in hot and heavy. Let me suck your toes just yet. It starts off with, quote, Bryce stiffened and Hunt laid his free hand on her knees, squeezing once. And then, quote, Hunt rubbed a thumb over her knee. Now, these are really, they're very intimate, but it can also be very comforting.
Right.
And even if it's not sexual, because like with friends, it can be a hand on the knee, you know, just a good pat and stuff. I'm not going to lie. Thumb on the knee, rubbing thumb. A little slutty.
On Hunt's part.
Right? A little too hot.
Yeah.
But again, you're still in the comfort zone. Now, I'm about to go into his more explicit thoughts. And I think it's really important how we get to those explicit thoughts. Because right before he goes on his dirty little mind tangent, him and Bryce are going back and forth. He's kind of already lured her out of her own mental state. And now they're brainstorming. They're thinking, okay, well, if it's Sabine, then why did she do this? How, what are the motivations? What's going on? And they're going back and forth. They're bouncing off of one another. And you're seeing equals and you're seeing a partnership. So now that we're getting, and I think it's really important again, because you're like, hey, what the fuck, Hunt? Why are you being horny for her now? I want to say, like, that happens right before this quote. Bryce mused, toying with her toes. They were painted a deep ruby. Ridiculous, he told himself. Not the alternative, the one that had him imagining tasting each and every one of those toes before slowly working his way up those sleek, bare legs of hers. Bare legs that were mere inches from him, golden skin gleaming in the first light. He forced himself to withdraw his hand from her knee, even as his fingers begged to move, to stroke along her thigh, higher. We're not here to kink shame Hunt. We don't do that.
No.
But that isn't foot fetish. Like,
yes. Yes.
SJM, you wrote a foot fetish.
She Does wanted she to know? Diversify her male pool and their kinks.
There's one for everyone.
There is.
We talked, was it you, me, and our friend, Nicole? We were talking about foot fetish, or was it just me and Nicole talking about it?
It might have been just you and Nicole.
Oh, I was talking about, like, out of, like, I wouldn't be opposed to being with a guy who had a foot fetish if he funded my pedicures.
Right. Obviously. That's like, a requirement.
Give me a foot massage and make my feet pretty.
Yeah.
Whatever you got to do with them, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, all foot fetishness aside, this is hornier than we have ever seen Hunt, right? Like, he's always kind of, we went from, like, not 0 to 60. There's definitely been buildup, but this is, like, the most explicit that we've had from him. And he admits here that his mind has been drifting like this since the gun range, which I think was earlier that day.
2 chapters ago, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was, like, the same day.
Yeah, same day, same day.
So, I mean, he's aware that this is just, there's been a shift, mm-hmm. and the shift is recent, the shift is now. And again, it comes back to she's vulnerable. This, I mean, if you think about everything we talked about last episode and this episode, like, all is happening in one day. So much vulnerability happening in such a short amount of time. So it makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, as you were saying, vulnerability is hot to Hunt because he's never had that in his life. Mm. He hasn't had it with Shahar. He hasn't had it with any member of the Triari. This is new territory for him. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that he's getting off on it. I do think it's important to note that a lot of this feels not against his will, but against his better judgment. Mm-hmm. He talks about his fingers begged to move. It's a compulsion he can't even control.
Yeah.
So he probably knows talking about the motivations of a murderer is not a turn on. However, in this moment, I can't help but be attracted to you.
Right. It's like, yeah, yeah. So that murder was horrible. But like, can I touch your thigh?
Yeah, yeah, but, you know, can I just suck on your toes?
Just give me your toes. And the thing is, she wears so many heels. Mm-hmm. Those are calloused.
Yeah, they're probably dry.
You don't wear heels and not have calluses.
He's had lots of opportunity to look at her toes. Why is it now that he's deciding they're attractive?
He's in a safe space, too.
He's in a safe space.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to talk more about Bryce and Hunt's attraction for each other this episode.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm very excited about it.
Oh, we both are. Yeah.
As we were mentioning, motivations of a murderer, not exactly the time to get off on your rocks or rock your socks. I don't know. Whatever. Uh-huh.
There's rocks and there's being off of them.
Yeah. and that's where Hunt is right now. But I make this shift because I want to talk about the fact that the motivation of villains always come back to power. And I would love to see someone try to not make it about power. You know, I guess revenge, but that's still power over mm-hmm. someone who's wronged you. But mm-hmm. anyway, I bring this up because Hunt and Bryce are making a lot of assumptions based on very little information. They're making assumptions that Sabine killed Danica because Danica was more powerful and would have been prime. They're assuming Sabine was involved with Sandriel to become prime of all shifters. And what it's just telling me, A, is they're grasping at straws, but also this idea of power and villains is just so messy. And because there's so many opportunities for power, it's very easily to be led astray when mm-hmm. trying to identify the murderer.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising that they go in this direction, to be honest.
It's honestly such a genius red herring, too,
yeah.
on SJM's part, because in their brainstorming session, they're like, oh my god, they're after Micah. He's the poor victim here.
Right.
And quote, Tertian's death might have just been to fuck with Micah standing. For fuck's sake, she and Sandriel might even be in on it together, hoping to weaken him in the Asteri's eyes. it's done so well. Mm-hmm. Because you're reading that, you're like, yeah, this makes sense to me.
Yeah, totally logical.
Yeah, like, why wouldn't they do it just to fuck with Micah? And now, yeah, that's why, like, the reveal is going to be so dramatic.
And it's curious to me, and I don't know if this was part of your notes, but of course they're villainizing the women.
Right. It's easier for them to believe that.
Instead of believing Micah, who's a victim, mm-hmm. could have actually also been a villain.
It is very funny. I didn't write that, but good point. It's not without cause. Yeah. Like, you know, Zandriel tortured Hunt for years. Sabine is...
just an asshole.
Yep. But it is still easier to believe that versus it could potentially be Micah.
Right. Bryce tries to control her reaction to the news of Sabine potentially being involved in Danica's murder, as well as the uncertainty of their investigation in general, through physical exercise. Now, physical exercise is great. It's a common way for people to work off anxiety and, you know...
Not in this house.
Just not
here.
Well, not here. My girlfriend does it. I do not.
I'm looking at you and me and this cat.
I'm just going to lay on the couch. Thanks.
I'm going to drink some more caffeine and make this worse.
However, Bryce takes it to an extreme. She runs so much and for so long until she can hardly walk because of the pain in her old injury. I just want to acknowledge it. It's not unlike Hunt taking his scalding showers. Mm-hmm. A shower mm-hmm. is not a bad thing. Exercise is not a bad thing until you take it to the extreme. Mm-hmm. I also love this moment because we see a growing connection between Bryce and Hunt. He doesn't tell her she can't go, but he's like, I'm going to join you, which I think is growth, that he's not demanding what she do. He's just going to be like, I'm going to be there too, because it's stupid for you to run alone at 1 o'clock in the morning.
You're like, oh, it's just like, it's so sweet.
It is so sweet. And what I love more than anything is that he matches her pace. Quote, he'd stayed by her side the entire time, hadn't complained or spoken, had just kept pace. And I want to suggest in this moment, even though Bryce does not make this connection, for me, I think it demonstrates that Hunt is a better friend to Bryce than Danica ever was. Because Danica was always leading, demanding, mm-hmm. telling Bryce to follow. Mm-hmm. Whereas Hunt's just like, if this is what you want to do, I'm just going to be right there with you.
Yeah.
And I doubt Danica would ever do that.
There was a note that I almost made later in this episode, which now I can't remember, but I'm just going to try to remember now, that it's similar to Danica. But I just want, I was about to write that. I'm like, but it's not similar to Danica. Like, there's moments where it's like, oh, Hunt is just like a good replacement for Danica. But in so many ways, he's so much better.
It's such a more healthy relationship.
Yeah. Even though in this run, Bryce shuts Hunt out, you know, like she's like, I'm going to run. I don't want to talk to you. Fuck you. She doesn't really kick him out.
Right.
You know, and she lets him run next to her. Mm-hmm. I think that's her way of kind of showing, like, I feel safe with you.
And that she's comfortable with the companionship. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not in a place to talk. I'm going to shut you out with my music.
Yeah.
However, you can still be my companion and we can run together instead of telling him, you know, just fly overhead.
Right. Or her trying to get away from him.
Right.
Which I think she would have done much earlier.
Oh, yeah. I do have a question. Towards the end of this chapter, once they're back from the run, Bryce keeps lying to Hunt about the pain in her leg from her injury. And I wonder why she keeps lying about it. I know that this is something she's always hidden from everyone, that she has this reoccurring pain. I wonder to what extent the lying about the pain is almost symbolic of their attraction to each other, that it's just like, no, I know it's there, but I'm not going to acknowledge it. It needs to be hidden away. I don't know. I couldn't think of anything, obviously, when I wrote this.
Well, to me, this is a great example of women.
Mm, yeah. Women in general.
Yeah, because how many times, and this is such a popular thing where someone asks a woman, hey, does it hurt? And the answer is, yeah, no, it hurts. Yeah, it hurts.
Or no, I'm fine.
No, but well, they'll say it hurts, but that's it. Like, yeah. Or like, I'm fine. Or like, you know, like there's like the shrug that every single woman will do. Be like, yeah, it hurts.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of leave it at that where it's like, there's no other answer of like, yeah, it hurts, but I'm just used to the pain.
Right. Right. It's why women think men are babies, because we have a higher tolerance for pain because we're so accustomed to pain.
We're so accustomed to it. I love the videos on TikTok of the ones where they're like, put the period simulator.
Oh, on. Yeah, the electrodes.
Yeah, the tens. Yeah. And they just, they're like, and men just like freaking out. And even like a couple of weeks ago when I was on my period, I was just like, oh, yeah, that's painful.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to try to describe to men. They're like, it's not uncomfortable. Sorry, I'm going to go on a tangent right now.
Okay.
It reminds me of, okay, so there is a new birth control for men that's coming up, mm-hmm. that's like they're working on, and they have to inject something into, I think, the testicle, like one of the lines in there. And men, and they're like, okay, but if they do it, they have to have anesthesia. All they're doing is injecting into the scrotum.
Right.
When I got my IUD, that was the most painful experience I have ever had in my life. And that's because they are forcing you to have a contraction. They are literally cranking your cervix open. And I lived with my, I'm putting my cousin on blast right now. I lived with my cousin who was an OBGYN, and she just was like, it's going to be minor inconvenience. And every single OBGYN was like, it's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be uncomfortable. And when I showed up and they're like, oh, you're here alone. Oh, you didn't take medicine. Oh, you plan on going to work after this? I'm like, the fuck? Yeah, no one told me this was going to suck. Everyone just told me it's going to be uncomfortable.
Right.
And I went to work and I was dying. So when I think of Bryce and this whole thing, it just is like the epitome of the female experience.
Oh,
where
yeah.
it's like, she's in pain, mm-hmm. but what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. Just to continue on this tangent, it makes me so mad that a contraceptive for women that is acceptable, probably created by a man.
Yeah.
That causes so much pain. People, like, you felt it for months after.
Yeah.
Everyone I know who's ever had one feels it for months after. And men never have to experience that.
They don't. I'm going to keep going on the fucking IUD tangent. I was on it. I had the IUD for a year. And you remember, I was like, I can feel it. I can feel it. Every time I sat down, I swear I could feel it. And there was even a point where I had this pain on my, I just described it, on my right ovary. Like, I felt it. And it wasn't even a pain. I just felt something there. I kept advocating for myself, demanded to go get an ultrasound done. And I literally pointed to it and I said, right here, there's something right here. And they found a super tiny, tiny little cyst. And the doctor, even my cousin, was like, oh, it's too small. You shouldn't feel that. I'm like, but I literally just pointed it to you.
Stop gaslighting me.
Yeah. And I was like, every time I sit down, I can feel my IUD. And they're like, well, no, it's in place. You shouldn't feel it. And the second they took it out, pain was gone.
I despise the medical profession.
The shit they do to women, everything has been done for men, has been done for like
white men.
White men. Yes. Thank you. And Amy gave me such intense eyes with that one.
The shit they do to people of color is even worse.
It's so much worse. Okay, yeah, sorry. We can go on it.
Let's move on.
But you know what? This is actually a great transition because we're about to go to Mediwitch.
We are going to the Mediwitch. So in chapter 39, we see Rune's investigation takes him to the Mediwitch clinic. Mediwitch, however you want to pronounce it. Since you've read the book, you know that the Mediwitch is Hypaxia masquerading as a Mediwitch to become acquainted with society before she becomes queen. Instantly, Rune is attracted to her without knowing who she is. And I want to talk about why I think some of the reasons are in place for that attraction to develop, thanks to SJM. Let's start with the environment. The walls are painted white. Everything is clean, pristine. There's sunshine. Well, yes, this could be just your average clinic. It's a very average looking clinic. You also don't see white very often in SJM's books unless there's a reason. Think about Bryce's apartment. Bryce's apartment that Danica left for her is all white, symbolic of a new beginning. We see white in her other books, also symbolic of new beginnings or fresh starts. And I know that's symbolic for Hypaxia, but I think it's also symbolic for Rune. I think he wants nothing but a fresh start, a clean slate. I think he would love something like that. And I think he's attracted to it. We also know that there's music of a symphony playing in the background and that Rune finds Hypaxia's voice musical. Rune is very sensitive with his ears. He talks about how he's left lovers because of the noises they make during sex. We know he's sensitive to sounds.
And I relate so much to that. I was like, you and me both, Rune.
But everything about her presence in this setting is very pleasing to Rune. And I think that's part of the reason why that attraction starts.
There's something about Rune feeling so out of place, right? Like him being dressed in head to toe black and then being in this room where he stands out. Mm-hmm. I love your explanation, because when I read this, I was like, why is he attracted to her? Like, he should feel uncomfortable. He should feel like, I don't know, like he's with his dad or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But his dad isn't described in all white. This is right. A much more peaceful environment and setting. I love your breakdown, because I was just like, what are we doing here, Rune?
Yeah.
Why are we, like, I was like, daddy issues? What?
I think it's also because he does make a point to note that she has brown skin mm-hmm. and night black hair. Mm-hmm. So even though she physically contrasts against the white, she belongs here.
Yeah.
And I think Rune has a vision of, like, even though I feel like I stand out, I actually don't have to stand out. Mm-hmm. I can belong here too.
Yeah.
That's my point of view.
I like that.
I also want to call out the fact that there's a little snippet when Rune is looking around the clinic waiting for Hypaxia. He sees pamphlets on a bunch of different things, one of them being scar therapy. We're going to learn later on, I can't remember if it's this book or Sky and Breath, but Rune has burn scars on his arms from when the Autumn King disciplined him as a kid. So he uses tattoos to cover up those scars. But there's such a thing as scar therapy?
When you made that connection, I was like, holy crap. I looked at it and I just immediately assumed Bryce and her scar. Mm-hmm. I just was like, it would make sense that Rune would look at that and be like, maybe he felt like you could never get that treatment, because then how are you supposed to explain it?
Right.
You know, exactly. Like, it's just like a thing that's out there for people that he probably felt like he could not do.
Right. Because if he were to do it, he would have to explain where he got the scars. Mm-hmm. He would have to out his father. That's and disloyal.
Think about it. It's treatment. You're going to have to do it more than once. Right. So it's going to have to be multiple times of like, okay, like this is an issue. This is, you know, I'm going to have to face this trauma over and over again. Versus a tattoo.
Yeah, but if he's got sleeves like I know he does, that is hours and hours and multiple sessions of tattoo. Yeah.
Or maybe he's Faye. It could just be one really long session.
I think he's choosing to cover his pain with more pain, mm-hmm. but not the kind that's true healing.
Yeah.
He's just trying to cover it up with tattoos instead of seeking real treatment. I mean, don't get me wrong. Obviously, I love tattoos. I have tattoos. However, if you look at it from the point of view of healthy healing, mm-hmm. he is like Bryson Hunt in that way, in that he's chosen the route that will punish himself instead of seeking true healing.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you entirely. One thing I noticed, I'm going to make a TikTok video about it, and it's through this podcast that made me realize every single fan art I've seen out there of Rune is wrong, because they make his sleeves black, his tattoos.
Mm, instead of really colorful?
Mm-hmm.
I think that I've seen a few with colorful.
I don't know. I don't know.
Now I'm going to have to go look.
You're going to have to go tell me. I don't think so. Before Amy gets into the whole dynamic of food and everything here, because it's such a great... We haven't gotten a lot of food moments here.
We haven't gotten a lot of food.
So when it happens, I'm always like, yes, Amy, speak. But this part just kind of makes me laugh. Rune is asking her about the horn, and he's not being subtle about it.
No, he's not.
He says, quote, legend says it was made with magic and could be used with the starborn gifts. Yes, from the first war. And then Hypaxia is like, oh, yeah, the horn.
Yeah.
And his thought is none of the other witches had gotten it so quickly. Maybe they were like, oh, shit, he's looking for the horn.
I can't say anything.
I don't want to deal with that. Yeah, people keep dying.
It's true.
Right? Like, people are dying. This guy is part of the Ox. Yeah. No one's hot enough for that.
Yeah.
To risk it.
Yeah, it's true.
It just was such a dumb moment of, and I'm going to blame Rune. I'm not going to say this is SJM, but just like the...
Rune's dumb.
Whoa, she got it and she's pretty and her hair soft and her voice is nice. Girl, I like girl.
You know, I think men can't have it all. He's hot and he's buff. He can't have a brain too.
Fair. I've asked for too much.
You really do.
That's on me.
So let's talk about food in this scene. And it, like Jack said, I feel like there is a lot less use of food in a symbolic way in this novel. And so I really had to dig in and think about what's happening in this scene. So Hypaxia asks Rune to wait until her lunch break so that they can talk about what he wants to talk about. When Hypaxia comes out, she serves Rune lunch as well as herself, even though Rune's like, oh, you didn't need to feed me. It's totally fine. In return, Rune pours Hypaxia's tea for her in addition to himself. And Rune smells the tea. I can't remember if he tastes the tea, but never once does he actually consume any food.
Oh.
The whole time it is Hypaxia who's eating. She's eating the grape. She's putting honey on the cheese and bread. But we never get Rune consuming anything.
Talk about trust issues.
Well, I mean, he might not be hungry. It's fine.
She's eating dates and grapes. It was a sad, pathetic lunch. That was my note on that. I was like, what are you trying to convey?
It's a charcuterie board is what it
is. There was no cheese, Amy.
There was cheese.
Okay, allowed.
How I interpret this is Hypaxia is in control here. We know, having read the book, that she's kept her identity a secret. Mm-hmm. We also can tell she's extremely smart. And Rune has sought her out for her knowledge. So she's really commanding their interaction here because of her knowledge, because she knows who he is, but he does not know who she is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of power going on right now, even though Rune doesn't even know it. He's like totally oblivious.
Like at one point when he was like, oh yeah, that Hypaxia, and she kind of pauses. And in my mind, her thought is, he really is a dumbass.
Yeah, honestly.
Right? Like, does he think I wouldn't be able to guess the horn? Does he not know who I am?
Yeah. And it begs the question, was Hypaxia testing Rune?
Mm.
And I think she was.
And I don't think he passed. I think he passed in the sense that he's very kind. Like,
yeah.
Rune is a very nice, honorable, dumb man.
Right. I think what she got out of this interaction, because she does say, you know, I look forward to seeing you again or whatever. And it's not a sexual invitation, as Rune notes. But I do think it's a genuine invitation. Yeah. I do think she's like, this is a pleasant fae.
Yeah.
And I could get along with him if I needed to.
Yep.
There were no red flags for me.
I mean, and for her, she really gets to be like, oh, this is the guy that I'm engaged to.
Right. Exactly.
And it's like, it must be really relieving to see Rune. I mean, you know, he's a good looking guy, but he's so sweet too. Like,
yeah.
She comes out with her apparently charcuterie board and he sees her and he's like, he jumps up to go help her immediately.
Yeah.
You know, we could do a lot worse than Rune.
We really could. Like, and if he knew who she was, she would interpret all of this as a facade.
Yeah.
But because he knows nothing about her, obviously, and he cannot figure it out for himself, she's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
A little dumb.
So for this part of the discussion, I'm going to have a little bit of a book two spoiler because I think it's important for the conversation now. And if you haven't read book two, jump ahead a little bit. You know, you mentioned earlier about Hypaxia's skin color and how it's mentioned. She has dark skin, dark hair.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really important to know that SJM is doing that because we don't, like you said, we don't see that again, mentioned again. And SJM has been doing that where she'll introduce a character of color and then it's never brought up again. And we asked one episode, our listeners, hey, what are your thoughts? Mm-hmm. And overwhelmingly, the thoughts that we received from an inner email where it has been, she needs to do better. Like, you know, mention it because she talks about all these other characters with their fair skin, gold skin, but she never comes back to characters of color who are darker skin tone to mention them.
Right.
And again, why that's so important is because in book two, when we find out that Lydia is her half-sister, Lydia, who is white, who is fair, Hypaxia's skin tone is used to show the juxtaposition to Lydia's whiteness. And now it becomes her skin tone is a device in a way.
It is, yeah.
To kind of throw us off of Lydia.
Yeah.
And you know, just wanting to say, like, hey, we recognize that SJM brought in a character of color and we love it. Love to see it. Happy for it. These are just thoughts that we have, thoughts that listeners have brought in. And, you know, it's just ongoing conversation.
Yeah. And I also want to point out, we are hit over the head so many times with the fact that Bryce's skin tone is golden and Hunt's skin is tan.
Mm-hmm.
But with Isaiah and Hypaxia, their skin is called brown or dark brown once.
Yeah.
And honestly, for a long ass time, I thought Hypaxia was pale because Lydia, in my mind, is also right? pale.
I forgot that, again, kind of going still in the spoiler for book two,
Baxian.
I didn't realize he's also has a darker skin tone.
Does he?
Until I saw fan art.
I couldn't recall that Hypaxia had brown skin until I saw fan art.
Yep.
And then I made sure to pay attention when she was introduced.
Yeah. And the reason, again, like when we have other comparisons, and maybe SJM's uncomfortable and doesn't know how to describe it.
Right.
I'm pulling excuses here. I get that. But like, she's comfortable when talking about the Viper Queen, her moon skin, her moon white skin.
Yeah.
She's really comfortable talking about comparing white skin to like opals or,
right,
you know, translucent. And like, you know, she's beyond her main characters.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing, is that these are supporting characters.
Yeah.
She does it to the other ones when they have fair skin. And again, maybe pulling things, maybe she just doesn't know how to, but yeah. You know, you can learn.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely something to be learned.
Mm-hmm.
I also recognize that two things. I want to recognize my own faults as a reader.
Yeah.
For not recalling who has darker skin tones.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though SJM doesn't, like, says it once and never says it again.
But
why did I make the assumption?
Yeah, in my mind, I delete that so quickly.
Right, right. And I recognize that's a fault of my own.
Absolutely.
I
do that same here. Same.
Lot. However, to your point, there is an opportunity for SJM to do more with her description,
mm-hmm.
to make it meaningful so that it does stick as a reader. And I recognize, having read the fifth season by mm-hmm. N.K. Jemisin, she does such a great job of describing all the different
skin tones
that are all dark.
Yep, yep.
Or that are not pale. Like, pale is like the weird thing.
Yeah.
But everyone has different shades of brown, and she does such a great way of describing it. And I think that's where us as readers and writers need to do more to branch outside of what we read.
Yeah.
Normally,
yep.
So that we can learn from other authors who have done a good job.
I think I'm so happy you brought that up, because you said earlier of, like, you know, as a reader, I'm not doing a good enough job of remembering that, categorizing it. And there's that saying of, like, default white.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what my brain does. And I need to step it up too. So I've been working on that, especially with this book, where when there's a scene with Isaiah, like, really putting that in my head.
Yeah.
I will give SJM props for this. A lot of authors are in the fault of doing this thing where when they compare darker skin tones, they compare it to food.
Yeah.
SJM doesn't do that. So I want to give her props. And that, because that is a, we don't do that, guys. Don't do that.
It's another issue that we see in writing from Caucasian white authors,
mm-hmm.
that they compare darker skin tones than theirs to food.
Yeah.
Talk about food as power.
Right?
We should not be doing that.
You just hurt my brain. Oh my goodness.
Right. So, I mean, and your friend Shay has talked about this with us before as well.
Yep.
Like, no, there's other colors than chocolate.
Coffee.
Caramel.
Right? Or if you're anyone who's cooler than us, caramel. But yeah. And, you know, I think it's an ongoing, important discussion.
Yep.
I hope, listener, you tagged along, and I hope no one feels threatened by having this conversation.
Right.
Because of how important it is.
Yeah.
And because as readers and as writers, you and I, it's important to, like, exercise our brain. Think beyond what our own imagination does.
Yeah. I also want to say, And I know this is a complete tangent, but I think it's important for this discussion. I've seen a lot on threads of diverse authors writing, saying, please stop asking me to be part of your diversity panel. I want to talk about the fun things too.
Right.
And so it's our responsibility to go and do the research. We shouldn't be relying on the people who have this experience all the time. Yeah. They have a lot of knowledge to share with us, but they want to engage in the fun conversations too.
It's not up to other people of color to educate us.
Right.
It's up to us to educate ourselves.
Right.
And that's why, you know, Amy and I, Amy's half Chinese, I'm half Hispanic. We are both white passing.
Yeah.
We are.
And we identify as white.
And we identify as white. And it's like, you know, even with like our mindset of already being culturally aware, because I'd say we are more culturally aware than like other people. We still do these things.
Yeah,
so,
we still struggle.
Yeah, we still struggle. So, yeah, I hope people stuck along with us on this one because
It's important.
It is important. And I think it can be fun to push yourself and try books you wouldn't normally try and have characters you wouldn't imagine. And to like, if you have to pull up fan art of Hypaxia, of Isaiah, of Bryaxis? No.
Baxian.
Baxian. Thank you. I keep calling him Pollux in my head. I know that's not right. Baxian, like if you have to have the fan art there with you,
yeah,
then do it. But like you can make this such a great exercise for your brain.
I agree.
Yeah.
I personally vow to read more books by more diverse authors because I want to create my own dictionary of how to describe different skin tones and hairstyles and whatnot. Because it will only make my own writing better.
Absolutely. You know, and I promise to read as many smutty books by women of color.
People.
With diverse authors and diverse characters. This is the tangent episode.
Oh, seriously. You guys, it was going to be a short episode. Now it's going to be long with our tangents. So now that tangent's over, let's move on to chapter 40. On the other side of Lunathian, Victoria uses Isaiah as a messenger to tell Hunt and Bryce that she's found something in her search for the Crystallis demon. And I find this very interesting because why does Victoria send her superior to be the messenger to Hunt? And is it because she's paranoid and accustomed to not communicating certain things over the phone? It's the first time I've really been cognizant of that, and I think is a clue for why Victoria is part of the betrayal later on.
Mm-hmm.
She's already doing some shady shit, even though her research into the Crystallis demon is not shady because she's doing shady shit on the side. Mm-hmm. She's accustomed to communicating in ways that are not traceable. And I just want to point that out.
She's a shady person.
She is a shady person. She's a wraith.
A wraith, I tell you.
Hunt can tell in this exchange of information that Isaiah's not doing great because Sandriel is at the Comitium and everyone is losing their shit. And it's a sweet moment when Hunt offers Isaiah help. Quote, if you need anything from me, let me know. And Isaiah is shocked. In 200 years, I'm sure he's never heard that come out of Hunt's mouth.
It's such a, like, low bar.
It's such a low bar, but it says a lot.
Yeah, it wasn't even saying, can I help you with anything?
Right. Or like, let me do this for you. No, it's just like,
let me know if you need anything. Let me know.
But it means a lot for Isaiah to be shocked by it. And what this is showing me is that Hunt is continuing to be cognizant of his own transformation since seeing Philip Briggs and is trying to extend an olive branch. Between this and willing to accompany Bryce on a run, it's showing me that Hunt is ready to build connections in a way that he's not been willing to since basically the fall of Shahar.
You know, Bryce is just such a good influence on him.
Give Bryce the credit.
He's learning his please and thank yous.
Yes, he is.
But when I was reading this, I'm like, God, Hunt, like, this is so pathetic. Like,
yeah.
But then I have to remind myself, he's been tortured for hundreds of years at this point. He's only fresh out of it for like 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. So, all right, cool. Like, that's great. But it's more than just Bryce helping him learn how to not be an asshole. It's a sign of healing. You know, if you think about the mindset Hunt must have been in for those hundreds of years of being tortured, he couldn't offer anyone anything. He was just trying to keep himself together.
Yeah. And I mean, part of it is he's been utilized. Mm-hmm. He's been an assassin, not only for Micah, but for those that have used him previously. Sandriel. Yep. I think there's an angel called Ramuel that used him. He's used to be taking advantage of. So for him to offer help is to say, I trust you to not take advantage of me.
Yep.
And that feels like a huge step for Hunt.
It does.
The infamous cell phone makes a reappearance here. Now, we discover not only is the cell phone used for retaliatory pictures, it's now a vehicle for Bryce to start changing her display name. And it's a great comedic through line for this second half of the novel. But I also feel like it represents their growing connection, that they are developing a friendship.
Yeah.
And that friendship is based on bickering, banter, jokes, annoying the shit out of each other. But that's how they built their bond. And I think what makes their friendship so genuine to me.
Yeah.
And I just love it.
It's so sweet. It's also just so relatable.
Yeah.
I can't imagine any person whose best friend is named their best friend's name in their phone.
Right. I mean, you were Jack Sweet and Low for a long time.
Right. And you were something else in my phone that I'm not going to say.
Because it's
I'm going to take that out. I'm going to bleep out. I don't want people to know that.
Yeah, that's fair.
It just shows that it's intimacy. It's like one of my favorite things to do is, you know, if I'm getting someone, like if I'm typing someone in, like our friend Nicole, when I first saved her on my phone, we were, I met her through writing group. So I saved her as Nicole writing group, except I misspelled Nicole and group and I never changed it. And then Heather, our other friend, I saved her on my phone as Heather, Nicole's friend.
Nice.
Misspelled Nicole and Heather.
Of course you did.
I'm not going to change it.
Yeah.
Well,
and now you and I are half Amy brain. Half brain, Jack half brain.
Yeah. Yeah. With the emojis.
Yeah.
Coordinating. But, you know, to that point, Bryce changes her contact info on Hunt's phone as Bryce rocks my socks. And I'm going to get into it later, what I think the photos kind of represent. For the meantime, you know, just admire this little cuteness. And the fact that Bryce admits that she saw him plug in his
figure out his password.
Figure out his phone password. And
he doesn't change
it. He doesn't change it. And that makes me so happy. And you know what? It's now my official new red flag. If he's not willing to give me his password and just let me know it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to go through your phone, but, like, I should be able to change my name.
Right.
Bryce is not happy about the fact that they have to fly in the rain and tries to find excuses to fly. And Hunt tells her, don't be a baby. And Amy's note here, I'm going to read it, was patronizing, mocking her fear. That's a valid interpretation. My interpretation is, I think about in a few chapters, he is going to kind of challenge her again, and she's going to respond with a smile. And this is her level of communication. It's sarcasm. It's snark. It's everything. And I think the reason why she's able to let it go is because he's proven he respects her.
Yeah.
Now he can get away with, oh, don't be such a baby. Because it's like, well, I know you don't think I'm a baby. Also, no one wants to get that wet. That's like, I'm uncomfy with that. What I do love is how Hunt tries to tempt her. Mm-hmm. Once Hunt gets Bryce off the ground and they're flying, he's trying to get her to look, right? He's like trying to get Bryce to stop cowering and enjoy the city. And he says, look around, Quinlan, enjoy the view. I like the city when it rains. And he's just trying to offer a piece of himself in that moment. And just saying, like, hey, like, this is a thing that I enjoy, and I want you to share that. Now, that's not the thing that gets her to look.
Right. That's not the thing that gets her to look. He tells her he'll buy her a milkshake, and she's like, okay, I'll do it for ice cream, which I understand. But I do appreciate, even though he teases her, it is a marker for the development of their relationship, right? That he's teasing her good-naturedly, not to spite her. She's willing to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole reason why he's adamant about flying is just because he wants to share a piece of himself, which is really, really sweet.
Yep.
Instead of saying, I want to share this part of myself with you. Come on. He's going to communicate on her level. He's going to tease her. He's going to offer her ice cream. He's like, and I can understand that.
I'm going to call you a baby and I'm going to give you ice cream.
Okay.
All right.
By the time Hunt and Bryce get to the lab, Bryce is drenched and cold. Quote, she instantly wrapped her arms around herself, teeth chattering at the shock of going from the storm into the crisp cold. Bryce found herself shivering in the doorway of a spacious office. It's a very uncomfortable setup. And why does no one offer her, like, a blanket or something to dry off on and to help her be warm? And it's curious to me why it was so important for SJM to have this scene play out with Bryce drenched and cold, why it's important for the rain to be taking place at this time. And I think I finally figured out by chapter 41. So I'm just going to put a
hold on
in
that. All right. All right. I'm just trying to imagine, like, I even hate when I'm out of the shower and the water's no longer running on me. If my hair gets on my body, mm-hmm. if it's not up immediately, I just hate that feeling.
Okay.
And she is drenched. She is cold. And Hunt sells her walk fast when he sees that she's cold, as in, like, warm it up.
Yeah.
And I felt like it came off a little cold. Like, it's not like he gave her a playful smile or he winks at her. You know, it was, like, colder than what we've been seeing Hunt be.
He's all down to business.
Right. And that's kind of where this comes into, where I think that he's trying to be a tough guy. Mm-hmm. And he's starting to be like, all right, I'm about to see Victoria. I'm going to be fucking tough. Mm-hmm. And then he caves immediately.
Yeah, it is a curious shift. It's as if he's like, oh, I'm at work. I've got to put this persona back on.
Right? But it goes away so fast.
Yeah, he doesn't know how to balance it.
Not at all. Let's get into appearances. Bryce think Hunt looks better when he's wet. Shirt clinging to his muscles while she was, quote, all too aware as she extended a hand of how her hair now lay flat on her head, thanks to the rain, of the makeup that had probably smeared down her face. And it's just, like, another thing where it's like men get to look good in shitty moments. Mm-hmm. And because Bryce puts in the time and effort to look good, mm-hmm. if things are disrupted, then we're assuming, like, she's assuming that it looks bad. And, you know, she's probably not wrong, you know?
She's probably not wrong. I also wondered if she feels threatened by Victoria. Mm-hmm. And that's why she's hyper aware of how she looks right now.
Yeah.
Because she's meeting Victoria for the first time.
Yeah.
Or, and, well, not first time. But no, you know what I mean.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point. I think it's like, you know, she's also just really aware of her own attraction to Hunt. Mm-hmm. And it's like, God, there he is looking gorgeous. And I look like shit right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I also love that she doesn't dwell on it. You know, she's just kind of like says it, accepts it, and is like, well, this is what I'm going to be now.
Yeah.
I'm a rat, a drowned rat. So, like we were saying, Hunt kind of just started off with a tough guy exterior. Like, you better walk fast. Sugar tits. That's for walking. We're going to be in here.
Not say sugar tits.
We're going to be hardcore business here. And immediately he caves. When Victoria just kind of gives, she's not even like fully flirty.
Yeah.
She just gives her like a kind of flirtatious smile. Mm-hmm. Quote, Hunt grumbled. She does that flirty smile with everyone. So don't bother being flattered. I love that he feels like he has to throw that in there.
Yeah.
Because just in case Bryce is like blown away. And I was like, you're right. I am going to leave you for the Wraith.
I mean, what if Victoria is a killer lesbian?
Maybe
he feels threatened.
Maybe like she's Ruby Rose.
Yeah, maybe.
Except I saw Ruby Rose in person.
She's tiny.
She's so tiny. Brie Larson, though. Killer lesbian.
Killer lesbian.
Is she gay?
She's queer.
Okay. Yeah, she could get anyone she wanted.
Yeah, she could.
Hunt decides to mark his territory by putting a hand on Bryce's thigh, and he keeps it there, and he keeps doing these little things like wrapping his wing kind of around Bryce, mm-hmm. keeping his wing touching her. And if there's anything we know about wings is that it's very important to the men, right? Or the person who has the wings. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. we saw that in ACOTAR where, you know, it's like, oh, careful with the wings. They're sensitive. And, you know, I think it's fair to say rules apply here. You know?
Spoiler for the prologue of Flame and Shadow, Crescent City 3, because that did come out earlier this week.
Yep. We're still processing, guys.
We're still processing. Because the prologue for Flame and Shadow has come out, mm-hmm. we learn that it's also a sign of possession. Because Lydia talks about it from her point of view.
Yep.
That the wing is touching her is a sign of possession constantly.
And it is such a bold move for Hunt to make because it does bite him in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just like give an instance of this, you know, intimate moment where Bryce is talking about the Cristallos demon and she's a little strained by that. And it says, quote, Hunt's wings spread a little farther around her, but he said nothing. So he doesn't even have to do anything to be there for Bryce. Like everything about him is showing protectiveness.
Right.
Now, before I wrap it up, this whole like how it backfires on Hunt, I just want to say like SJM as SJMing right
real
now.
Real hard.
Yep. Victoria talks about, you know, when the Cristallos demon shows up, there's a dip in temperature. What's that dip in temperature going to be?
77 degrees.
Of course. Right. Because SJM probably wrote 7 degrees, was like, that's not enough. 77. The holy number, as holy according number. To this world. Now, back to Hunt and Bryce. This, like I said, the intimacy, it backfires.
Mm-hmm.
And Hunt let it backfire. Quote, Hunt's hand slid from her leg, leaving a cold spot in its wake. A glance at his face saw the cause. Victoria now held his gaze, her own full of warning. Can you remind me, like, Victoria's not ranked higher than him. Hunt doesn't give a fuck if anyone's ranked higher than him.
No, he doesn't care.
He doesn't care. But there's something about her gaze that made him care?
Yes. And this brings me back to the first chapter in this episode. I don't talk about it until the breadcrumbs, but Hunt's not very good at hiding his interactions with Bryce mm-hmm. in front of his fellow angels. So, for example, when he's texting back and forth with Bryce on the rooftop, Isaiah says something to the effect of, there are things worse than death.
Yeah.
And
I couldn't tell in that moment if he was like trying to get Hunt to be with Bryce or warn her away.
I don't know that he was warning her away, but I think it was a warning of you could suffer death, but it could be worse if something happened to Bryce.
See, I interpreted that as there's worse things than death, as you've been alone for so long.
Mm-hmm.
There's worse things than being alone and mm-hmm. dying alone, my friend. Yours is probably the right one.
I mean,
mine's is the romantic one.
I think it's equivalent. I think that they're the same. And it is for both Isaiah and Victoria, who have also fallen
mm-hmm.
like Hunt. It's kind of a, hey, you're risking a lot by putting yourself in this situation.
Yeah.
And Hunt's not very good at picking up those clues.
No, he's not. And he just feels like he just has to keep putting his arm on her. Yeah, you know, he can't stop, but that's because, spoiler for book two, they're mates.
I want to get into the reason why I think Rain is really important right now. It's going to sound a little wild, and I think it explains a lot of what's going on that we're questioning about Hunt. I want to suggest that the Rain right now is representative of Hunt and Bryce's mutual attraction that they cannot dispel.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is in the last chapter, in chapter 40, Bryce was against going into the rain. She was trying to fight it and Hunt wouldn't let her. And in the process, she encounters these moments where she can't fight her attraction to him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to read a couple quotes in a little bit to explain that. Now we see kind of something similar happen in chapter 41. Bryce is trying to coax Syrinx out into the rain. And we know from previous episodes that Syrinx is representative of Hunt. Syrinx cost $233,000 to free. Hunt is 233 years old. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a clear tie between the two of them. Syrinx only accepts being out in the rain once Hunt does the coaxing himself. It's almost as if Hunt has to convince himself that it's okay to be attracted to Bryce.
Yeah.
And Rain has also, on top of all of this, increased their forced proximity. They're already in a forced proximity trope. He has to guard her. He has to live with her.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rain is forcing them even closer together.
It is a forced proximity trope. Oh, that made me so happy.
Yeah. The little, like, wiggle you just did. So let me read these quotes. So from chapter 41, quote, Hunt was keenly aware of every part of his body that met every part of hers as he scooped her into his arms. And from the previous chapter, from Bryce's point of view, quote, she might have pressed her body a little harder against the solid wall of his. He might have tightened his grip too, just a little bit. for the rain to happen right now. There is truly no need for rain.
Mm-hmm.
It does nothing for this story.
Mm-hmm.
Except I think it forces Bryce and Hunt to really acknowledge that this attraction is not going away.
Mm-hmm.
And they're leaning into it a little bit more. And we're going to see them lean into it more, even after the rain is gone.
I love this. I love it. Can I play a little bit with it? And you tell me. So we're going to, in a little bit, get into, they go on a hunt, they come back, Bryce showers, right?
No.
And in my notes, I kind of talk about, like, we haven't had the same kind of, like, rebirth representation mm-hmm. with showering like mm-hmm. we have in other seasons with mm-hmm. the ACOTAR series. This and what you're telling me is giving me that rebirth.
Yeah.
That bathing, that cleansing, that it is safe to do this.
Yeah.
And I like that in a world where everything is technology mixed with magic, they can only be reborn through natural elements.
I love it.
Yeah.
I've got goosebumps. I completely agree with you because all of this is happening 24 hours after the gun range.
Yep, yep.
Literally after they've had an interaction that changes the nature of their relationship
mm-hmm.
forever.
Yeah.
Where they've fully accepted each other and their vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
The rebirth is so important, and I completely am on board with you that the rain represents that because of the way their interactions have changed. And I think we're going to talk more about that this episode.
Yep. Good job.
Makes me excited.
You did great.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to part one of this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Tune in Thursday for part two, where we finish covering this week's chapters.